My guest, however, is the philosopher at large in the city of Tamaki, Makaurau, Anne Kerwin, who's joining me from, I think, somewhere near Mangafo, Mount Eden. Kia ora, Anne. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. Good evening.
Oh, you're on the Skype line tonight, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm Zooming. We're Zooming, Brian.
Oh,
Zooming.
I wonder if it's, yeah. if you listen closely enough, whether there's a difference in the sound, because I can't spot it if there is. And that's completely a rather esoteric thing that a sound person like me might ask. How's it going, the lockdown this time, Anne?
Well, it's rather brief, so I haven't quite gotten used to it, and I hope I don't have to get used to it
for a very
long time. And in that regard, I am like almost every other New Zealander.
Now, you wanted to talk about cheating because somebody else has written about it, somebody, a philosopher from the United States who passed away a few weeks back.
Yes, actually she was a law professor and I had never heard of her. And I read the obituary in the New York Times, and in the obituary it said she wrote on about 30 books on a wide variety of issues and a very lively woman. And I saw that one of her books was Cheating, and another one, which will be released after her death, unfortunately, is Ambition. And I thought cheating sounds, well, it's a very topical thing. And so I did get it and read it. And what interested me about it, particularly the introductory chapters, she didn't come at it from the point of view of the law. She came at it from the point of view more of modern behavioral psychology, social psychology, cognitive psychology, and it added some dimension to kind of our own processes of, stumbling into cheating and wallowing in cheating and creating cultures of cheating that often philosophers don't consider that much. And so I found it very interesting.
How does the Oxford English Dictionary define cheating, if we go to that as an initial source here?
We always do that, don't we? Fraud, deceit, and swindling. Sort of an old-fashioned word.
Yeah, lovely. Actually, quite lovely.
I think so. And she also offers another definitions of acting dishonestly, unfairly, or in violation of a rule in order to gain an advantage. And that's what I think marks out in some ways cheating from some other types of dishonesty, is we're violating a rule, or we're doing something that we shouldn't do that's not available to other people because we want an advantage. And in gaining that advantage, sometimes other people are harmed.
What's interesting is that she covers it in a wide range of life experiences.
Mm. Yes, starting with
sport.
Indeed, very, very fulsome chapter, Brian, very fulsome chapter. Her book is called Cheating, Ethics in Everyday Life. And the first sentence of the book is, cheating is deeply embedded in everyday life. And as a lawyer, law professor, looking at all of the rules and regs that we come in and all the violations of laws and laws we set in, it gives her a really good lens into what concrete everyday life situations where cheating is welling up and what might be done about it.
It's interesting if we just look at sport maybe for a moment, maybe more, because sometimes more than I think we know it, sport is an analogy for life. I mean, it's playing out a drama, and drama is, of course, mirroring life. And you will often hear people from the other side say, you support the All Blacks, and you'll hear Australians going, oh, the All Blacks cheat. Richie McCaw, he's a cheater. He's a good cheater, but he's a cheater. And then when on our side, it's either met with angry denial, no, he's not. Or sometimes when we do something a bit obvious, and I was talking about this yesterday, and forgive me, please, but, it's an obvious case of a New Zealander trying to get an advantage, which I'm sure the other team felt was unfair. Andy Hayden diving from a line out to win a penalty. Yeah. This is long, possibly before you'd even heard of New Zealand, Anne. And I remember watching that, and I know that the referee said later that it didn't influence his decision to give New Zealand the penalty. It was for something else. But I remember my father and I watching this at the age of 12, and we won that game by a point in the last minute. And I think we both felt rather embarrassed, but we were still kind of happy that we won. And maybe it wasn't so bad what we did. And yet a few years later, when another Australian bowled an underarm, everybody in New Zealand was outraged. Outraged. Really? Well, it seemed to be.
Those crooks.
So we seem to be blind when it's our team doing it sometimes.
Well, you know, those raises actually two different examples that she talks about of psychological studies. And there was a psychological study, just one that she cited, was two university gridiron teams in the U.S. And they had videos of their game. I think it was Princeton and I don't know, Princeton, Harvard or something like that. And so the psychologist took a bunch of Princeton students and showed them the game, and they were to note all of the instances of cheating in that game. And then the Harvard students, I don't think it was Harvard, but anyway, the opposing team's students also took notes of all the cheating that occurred in the game. And each side saw far more instances of cheating from the other team than they did of their own. And so that, you know, that's called in some sense motivated blindness or willful ignorance. And the other side of it is that one of the words that she uses that psychologists talk about, but philosophers don't often talk about, was ethical discomfort. And that sometimes in the situations with you and your father talked about it, you had some sort of ethical discomfort at, you know, seeing the win come by cheating. But there were also in your little reward systems, there was a big reward for, you know, and the country. The problem is that she sees is that these kind of conflicts, the conflicts between what one psychologist calls our want self and our should self, that they can be in conflict, and that by encouraging our want self rather than our should self, often enough, we become desensitized to our ethical discomfort. We become habituated to, you know, if you will, the acceptance of cheating, or even in some ways, the delight of cheating. And thus, we lose our inhibitions against that form of conduct, not only in sports, but perhaps in other areas of our life.
In other words, because you could focus on the harm done by those who are cheated against, and poor old Wales lost a test that maybe a lot of its rugby fans thought they were going to win and should have won. But in New Zealand, we were happy, and the team was happy, came back heroes. They won a Grand Slam. They beat of all four nations. And what possible harm was done to the All Blacks by this little bit of naughtiness?
Well, in New Zealand, I imagine probably not a lot. I imagine there was probably not a great deal of harm. But in general, philosophers and psychologists will often say that the harms to the cheater, there can be a loss of respect in inroads on your own integrity. And I think that does happen with people who pride themselves on their hard work and their discipline and their team spirit and their devotion to principles, and therefore they want a win to be an honest win. And over time, if these kinds of things happen, you lose that a bit, or that self-respect, unless you can earn it back.
But maybe they're just that the people that cheated were just, and this is now I'm drawing this out to look at life, maybe life more in general, that cheaters who get away with it are cleverer. And the clever ones are rewarded. And if you think about life in general, possibly some people would argue, well, yeah, there's a lot of sneakiness that goes on in various aspects of our lives. And that's the way it's always been.
Well, that is the way it's always been. And so this is nothing new. But of course, you know, philosophers are not happy about this, right? You know, you have Socrates and you have Plato and you have this. And There are costs to be paid, not only for the cheater. I mean, the cheaters sometimes get caught. Sometimes they get embarrassed. Sometimes they lose the admiration of people who who thought they were prospering by their own efforts. Your chances of getting caught may not be realistic, and you may get caught more and more. You may expose yourself to ridicule and shame. You know, what do they call it? The cancel culture that's happening now, where people are being called out for things that maybe in the past they shouldn't have been. I mean, they wouldn't have been. So there's that aspect of it, but there's also the aspect, to some degree, much of society depends on trust and fairness. And you will have societies where much of business is corrupt and many people simply cannot make a go of it. You know, and they get discouraged, and you have big class differences, because it is widely accepted that it is the situation that the people who can cheat will cheat.
Does Deborah Rhodes say anything? Sorry to interrupt there, but does Deborah Rhodes say anything, or did she say anything, past tense, about the fact that those with more money and power are probably more likely to get away with cheating, or at least already have the system set up to help them, compared to people with less money and power?
Well, no, she didn't talk about that, but I think that there are many, many, many cases of that, of course, and that is what gives a real loss to society, in a sense of discouragement, in a sense of unfairness, that the people who can, let's say if you were in the U.S., can afford fancy lawyers and delaying tactics and paying people off, can get off things, and the poor, honest person gets done for it. It also sets up a kind of a cycle of cheating. When, again, psychological studies show that when people feel that their situations have been unfair, they've been treated poorly, they're not rewarded properly, they tend to cheat more. It's sort of revenge cheating, but it's also, you know, I'm not getting my fair shake, so I'm going to take some.
Isn't
that? And that in itself gives rise to more. Yeah, go on.
Isn't that one of the reasons that a lot of people, maybe poorer white Americans, supported Trump? Was because they felt that the whole system in Washington was set up against them, and Trump was taking on the old establishment.
Well, that's what he told them, but they elected the biggest cheater in American history, and, you know, and they knew it. It was no, he already told people in a debate, you know, if you pay taxes, you're stupid. You know, and these are poor people that, you know, really get soaked for their taxes. And they knew he cheated on his wives. They knew his Trump University was convicted of fraud. He was convicted of fraud for it. They knew that his foundation, all of this stuff had been published. And, you know, the naive Democrats and other people thought, oh, people are really going to be turned off by this. But absolutely not. And he still won 74 million votes. Next time. In fact, that phenomenon inspired Deborah Rhodes to write this book.
So there we have it. So here are people who feel that the system cheats against them, that they have been hard done by the system. Maybe not individuals, but the system itself. And they elect somebody who has, to some extent, said, yeah, sometimes I play the rules, but I don't play them the same way as my opponent. And yet that's still okay, because he was their champion. They saw him as their champion.
Right, he was their champion. And the other thing is, I don't know that they all felt they had been cheated. There was a huge number of things, but there's a lot of evidence that people thought that they had lost their American way of life, which was an older, whiter, more conservative, not very diverse, not very professional society, in which they felt comfortable and they felt it belonged to them. And that loss, and evangelical Christians thought that the immorality of abortion, gay marriage, any sanction of gays, et cetera, was a terrible loss for the society. I don't think they tied it necessarily to corruption, but they wanted it back. They wanted it back.
Well, in the end, they lost
it.
It's
a very complex phenomenon, obviously.
But yeah. How then, if you've got so many millions of people who seem to think that the whole thing is skewed, then how do you, if trust is one of the reasons we should care about cheating, then how does a society get its trust back?
Well, that's exactly where the USA is. I mean, the majority of Republican voters think that Biden stole the election because they were told he stole the election. And this isn't even the white supremacist and the Proud Boys and all this. The big lie, as it's called, was that. And there are a great many people who absolutely believe it, in which case the question of how any kind of, you know, civil unity can come about in that country is really up for grabs, because the belief is sincere. The lie is false and demonstrably false, but the belief is sincere.
Anne, as always, it's fascinating talking with you. And thanks so much for joining us, and hopefully you'll be able to be back in the studio next time we have you on.
Well, in whatever way I appear, I'm absolutely delighted. Thank you so much, and thank the listeners.
Always a delight to have you on, Anne. Thanks, Anne, and good night.
Good night.
That's Anne Kirwan, philosopher at large, although not so much at large right now in the city of Auckland because it's in level 3 lockdown, but she will be back with more thoughts on thinking, on ethics in about 10 weeks.